it lower than Richard Nixon before he resigned presidency. You're laughing, but why do you think that is?
Because we're at war. And war unsettles people. We got a great economy. We've had 5.2 million jobs in the last 2.5 years. But people are unsettled. They don't look at the economy and say life is good. They know we're at war. And I'm not surprised that people are unsettled because of war. The enemy's got a powerful tool. That is to get on your TV screen by killing innocent people. And my job is to continue to remind the people it's worth it. We're not going to retreat hastily. You know, we're not going to pull out there before the job is done, and we've got a plan for victory.
But they're not just unsettled, sir. They disapprove of the job you're doing.
That's unsettled. That's what I see. That is. I see it as a war history.
Shut the hell up. You have the nerve to talk about how we have a great economy. Well, yeah, for Halliburton, Big Oil, TRW, Lockheed, Boeing, and other arms capitalists, hydro capitalists, and disaster capitalist corporations. And then you buffoon out that the enemy has a great tool by getting on TV and killing people. Well, boy, that's what happens when you invade other people's country. Hey, you want to buy some West Oakland head coffins? And then you talk about how I got a lot to do, and I'm not going to retreat. Nor are you or any of your friends going to strap on a rifle and go down to Iraq and physically face down the resistance. So it's easy talking all that no retreat nonsense from your lounge chair in the White House with a crack pipe in one hand and a bottle of Jack Daniels in the other. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check it. Listen at 103.3, 101.1 freakradio.org for Skid in Santa Cruz, 104.1, LUVER.com, Upstart Radio, 107.5, North Carolina, 96.3, Antelope Valley. Tune in to radioforall.net, which is the universe. Also check out Slave Revolt website, slaverevoltradio.blogspot.com, a couple of websites with slaves in arms, propagandapress.org and savagejustice.blogspot.com. We got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3 Slave Revolt.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see, where they've gone, they're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system. But they have no perception and no way to measure what the amount of energy that's going to flow out of that light off is going to do to the rest of the planets in the solar system.
one can see the various steps and elements of a fascistic style state emerging out of this horrific American experience take place day by day. Yet this barbaric enterprise has been a long time in the making. In this Beyond the Shadow segment called Fascism in America will be as simple as a jog in the park. We're going to explore this American way of being, this mindset, the concepts that have been deeply a part of the American experience. Keywords like scapegoating, racism, denial, sorry Arabs and Islams. And what I mean by that is that black folks in America have long been the perfect fit in this position. The brutal beatings and rape of a white woman named Trisha Melley on April 19th, 1989 in New York's Central Park gives a stark glimpse then and now at the real America. In 2002, the real rapist and violent assaulter, Martius Reyes, confessed to the jogging rape assault. His DNA was the only DNA that matched what was found on the woman's body. Reyes also admitted that he did this attack alone. The problem was that five black and Latino teens had been arrested, framed up, and convicted for attempted murder and rape. All by the time 2002 rolled around, had served hard time and had been welded down with violent felony convictions. We're going to explore this event step by step with all its shades of color and directions, and explore what I mean on how fascism in America will be as simple as a jog in the park. First, let's hear from DNA defense lawyer Barry Sheck from the Innocence Project, formerly one of the defense attorneys for OJ. This was on the eve of the new DNA evidence blowing the Gestapo cops of New York's case against the Central Park 5, CP5, into 1,000 pieces, along with Martius Reyes' personal confession. So let's check this out.
This is a really important historical moment in the history of the criminal justice system of this city and this country, because of the unbelievable attention that this case generated when it occurred. And as Councilman Perkins said at the very beginning, now is the time to move forward with some reforms that can make sure that what happened to these young men never happens to people like them again. And there is a very simple solution. It is time that we have videotaping of all custodial interrogations. It is time that we have mandatory videotaping of all custodial interrogations. This reform not only protects the innocent, it helps apprehend the guilty. Make no mistake about it, Matthias Reyes committed a rape on April 17th, 1989, two blocks away from where this terrible crime occurred in Central Park. He went on to commit 3 other rape robberies and a rape murder. From the district attorney's report, we now know that police had his name, identified him as having perhaps been the assailant in that April 17th case. Now, when you get false confessions from 14, 15, and 16-year-olds, it diverts your attention. You can't do ordinarily sound police work, and the real assailant escapes to commit more crimes. Peter Neufeld and I have this Innocence Project right here in New York City, Cardozo Law School. And when Judge Tejeda vacates these convictions and dismisses these indictments, we will then have 122 post-conviction DNA exonerations in the United States. In over 5% of these cases, there have been false confessions or admissions. In so many of these cases, there have been people like Matthias Reyes, serial offenders who were not apprehended because the wrong people were in jail and in some instances put on death row. Now, Mr. Morgenthau, Nancy Ryan, Peter Casolaro, the people who came forward and did this remarkable reinvestigation, must be commended for pursuing with honor and professionalism what must have been a very, very difficult thing to do. And now it's time for them, I hope, and the New York City Police Department and people of good faith in the criminal justice system all across this country to undertake a reform that we know works in Minnesota. Talk to the prosecutors there. Talk to the police. It's a reform that doesn't handcuff the police. They can interrogate bad cop, good cop. They can do everything Sipowicz does that's good on NYPD Blue. The camera is surreptitious. It makes a record. We know what Elizabeth Lederer did when she interviewed these young men 28 hours after their detention, but we do not know what went on in the most crucial and important times when these young men and their family members were being interrogated and these false confessions arose. And that's what had to be videotaped. And that's what will work. That's what will protect the innocent and help apprehend the guilty. And that's what should come out of this case.
Now, one of the things that is quite revealing about some of the things that Barry Scheck said is about Matthias Reyes. Matthias Reyes basically had been raping people around that area for a while. Reyes raped someone 2 blocks away from the Central Park area earlier. He had been involved in 2 other rapes, robberies, and murders. How he got caught was basically he had been involved with a similar type of rape with a similar type of MO, where he would brutally damage the woman that he was raping, and then physically beyond just the rape. He got chased by some people and ended up running right into the arms of a civilian who turned him over to the cops. Now, the cops had him listed as a possible suspect, but when he was turned over, they didn't even question him on that Central Park case. And part of the reason is because a whole furor and network had already served its purpose and had built up around these 5 black and Latino brothers being part of, as the New York Post described, a teen wolf pack. As one of the pig cops called them, mutts. They were using terms like wilding and all of that type of stuff. The Jigaboo then mayor, Dinkins, he got into the act, you know, calling names. So this whole furor. And then, of course, it was racialized in a way where, you know, the woman was white, the suspects, well, we know. And this lent to the whole black Latino predatorial type of imagery that's so easily gobbled up by the masses. It would be similar to, like, you know, this thing going on in Duke with the lacrosse team about this woman who claims that she was raped by three lacrosse members. Well, if this had been a basketball team full of black folks and she was a white girl, that whole image would have been turned into like this predatorial type of thing, and a demonization of the culture, and all of that stuff would have manifest, and outward condemnation on the culture at large that produces these types of people. But since, you know, the lacrosse people don't fit that, you know, colored image and stuff like that, and she's on the wrong end of the color spectrum herself, well, it's, you know, patience is what's basically being ballyhooed out to the public. And for the most part, especially on the sports stations that love these types of issues, you know, like when Kobe was caught up into it, they basically don't cover it at all. But in this particular case, it galvanized the whole New York area when you check out the documents, writings, etc., etc. Now, as Sheck has said, of the 122 cases that they've been involved in, 5%, you know, 122 cases when they got people out. And they get people out by DNA evidence. That's part of the Innocence Project. But 5% were later revealed, or over 5%, to be false confessions. In other words, where the police had somehow engineered a false confession from the particular people who were being charged and convicted, yet the DNA evidence later undermined it. Well, that begs the question, well, what about the cases where there is no biological material? So you can't just say it's a little bit over 5% where these cases prove that there are false confessions. But this leads to the other aspect. These guys were 14, 15, 16-year-old at the time. And the police, the various people who were involved with the prosecution, the district attorney, they did all kinds of manipulation. They didn't allow, in a number of cases, their families to have first contact. They didn't present them with parental guidance. They isolated them. And in some of the cases, they had these teenagers being interrogated by these manipulative lying cops for over 20 hours. So they engineered the story in the way that they basically wanted, meaning the police did, which exposes one thing. When Sheck says that what we need to do is have the cameras turned on from beginning to end, what he basically means is that in New York and all these other places outside of like Minnesota, what they do is they turn the camera on right after they've broken the person down to the point where they're ready to make a confession, thinking they're going to get a deal or just worn out, demoralized, etc., etc. So they turn the camera on then at that point. But the hours before where they're going through the process of breaking down the individual, they don't turn the camera on. So you don't see the whole coercion, the whole manipulation, the whole process of coercing and intimidation. And in cases of people like Burge, torture to actually get what they want. So, what many people like Sheck were calling for was videotape the whole process, everything. So that is all part of the public record. These raggedy cops, of course, don't want that because they don't want to expose their hand. So when Sheck talks about, well, people of good faith, you know, in the criminal justice system and all of that, should undertake this reform, because that's all it would have been if it had happened. And he says that this doesn't hamper the cops. But in reality, this reform would have hampered the cops simply because the cops' objective is not some kind of honest broker objective to quote-unquote simply get criminals off the street. There's another agenda, political, socialized agenda, an attack on specific groups of people. This is part of their role. This is part of the reason why they don't want these types of reforms in place. And this is also why Martíus Reis, who was obviously someone that they should have followed up on, was able to more or less slip through the cracks. And when Martíus Reis did confess to this years later in 2002, it had nothing to do with the police any more than the police catching him, because they didn't catch him. He was turned over by to them by a civilian. What had happened was, over his years in prison for another crime, he had kind of a change of heart and felt guilty about his past deed in the jogging case, and he willingly came forward with the evidence, the description of the particular rape that he alone was involved in, and willingly gave over his DNA, i.e. his blood, which then matched him up directly, irrefutably, to the rape of the woman. So this is how the process played itself out. Yet here we were in 2002, and you have to quote unquote have people like Barry Scheck simply ask for a camera to be turned on during the whole process. This gives an insight of how treacherous and how lopsided the system is, how it's designed not for true justice. It's obvious that they would have a full record if they were truly trying to have a full, accurate picture of how they got from one point to another point, or what they would like to say, a conclusion about the particular evidence. But of course, that's just not the case. And as books like And the Blood Cried Out expose, the justice being done within the system by those who are proponents and iron-fist killers-for-hire merchants within the system is not the case. Now, here's Emily Kunstler, daughter of the famed and courageous defense lawyer for the exploited William Kunstler, reading from her father's documents on defending one of the CP5 victims, Youssef Salim. Youssef was 15 years old at the time of the 1989 CP jogging beating and rape of Trisha Melly. So let's hear Emily read some of her father's experience in defending Youssef and his overall outlook of the whole case. Check this out.
Youssef had his rights violated from the beginning. I thought what the authorities did to this 15-year-old boy was outrageous. He did not confess, either in writing or on videotape. That was the only tangible evidence against him, was his oral admission, which he supposedly made to a detective. I appealed Youssef's conviction all the way up to New York's highest court, the Court of Appeals. On December 16, 1993, the court affirmed his conviction 5-1, rejecting my argument that the police wrongly isolated him from his family, friends, and friends while they elicited his confession. This confession was the only evidence that connected Youssef to the crime. In his dissent, which received little attention from the press, Judge Vito Tottone said, there was no justification for the authorities' actions in preventing defendant from gaining access to the helpful counsel of supportive adults who had gathered to assist him. That was the main point of my argument. The Court of Appeals ruling showed its racial bias. Had Youssef been white with a middle-class family, his police interrogation would have no doubt been stopped by knowledgeable parents or available attorney. Instead, his mother, aunt, and big brother were kept away from him. Judge Titone, I was pleased to see, also noted that the police lied to Youssef during his questioning when they told him first that they had taken his fingerprints from the victim's clothing, and second, that he might be released if he answered their questions correctly. The right person, a parent, a lawyer, or another responsible adult, might have prevented Youssef from making any such statements to the police without an attorney present. Finally, Judge Titone characterized Youssef's isolation and separation from his family and friends by authorities as an undisguised intention to exploit the defendant's youthful vulnerability. It is outrageous that Youssef's questioning occurred the way it did. He was only 15, and his constitutional rights were completely ignored. The judicial system of New York State has done to Youssef what some years ago in the South would have been done with a rope or a rifle. I am not surprised at the Court of Appeals' decision, because the court's role is to maintain social order. Keeping Youssef and as many blacks as possible in prison is a part of the function of the judiciary.
So as you could see, Kunstler was right on with what he noticed going on within the system. And it's quite fascinating, as Emily read some of her father's documents, how Youssef was never broken down to confess on videotape or in written word that he was a part of this. So the brother held strong, this 15-year-old brother who was under hours of manipulative interrogation, tricks that the police play, lies, etc., etc., this held firm. So they just made it up. They claim that he did an oral confession to one of the detectives. And this passed through the judge and the raggedy jury. Now, why I point this out as exposing how sick this system is that they went through all lengths to break down these various teenagers and then to get them to confess on video. That was the whole thing, because they knew that they didn't have any material physical evidence. So they went through this whole process after hours of manipulation, interrogation, to break them down and then get them, because that they knew that that would be an ironclad in today's climate with people's belief in the system, belief in the police, etc., and basically also just to use it as an excuse to convict Negroes, that would be insurmountable evidence for the innocent to try to get over. So Youssef doesn't go for it. He doesn't break down. So they just make up a story that he, the lone one, doesn't confess on video, doesn't do a written confession, but just told one of the cops. And that's able, in this great American illusion and deception game, to go right on by, be good enough for the jury, and Youssef also gets convicted. That just helps expose how insidious this sick system is. Now, and yet, even though Youssef, as it was clear, he didn't have access, immediate access to parental guidance. He didn't have access to his attorney. He was underage. By law, he was supposed to have parental access. You know, his mother, his aunt, his older brother, none of that. They intentionally kept him away, as documented evidence show, from his guardians, who were trying to get access to find out what was going on. Meanwhile, the police are lying to him, you know, it's part of the game, you know, saying they found his fingerprints on him, and that he might be released, and all of these things to wear him down psychologically, to get the suspect to a point of despair, saying, look, no matter what I tell these slobs, it does no good. They're just going to keep me locked up until I say what they want. And then after this whole process has gone on for hours and hours, the person starts to get dehydrated, hungry, demoralized. Then they say, well, you know, you might be released if you just say what we want to hear. So through that process, especially for someone who's underage, you know, some teenager, you can see how with this isolation, with this demoralization, with these intimidating forces for many people being pressed upon them, how some people would break. Yet, when Kunstler took this to the Slob court in 1993, the court still affirmed Youssef's conviction. This exposes the various elements of a draconian society that are deeply embedded within this sick society. This is undeniable. These aren't things that are just mishaps. Every element along the way, from how the corporate media portrayed it, how the larger quote-unquote dominant population gets into a knee-jerk response, how the police respond, how the district attorney engineer the apparatus, how the courts affirm the whole process of the destruction of black and Latino males, gives a glimpse of how the elements of social, political, diabolical control and the stripping and abdication of any true human rights are deeply a part of the American fabric. These aren't just elements that are just quote-unquote emerging now. As this whole aspect helps reveal, these are a continuation, as Kunstler said, from the rope, the lynch rope, in the rifle days, and instituting it within to the criminal justice system in a more modernized, more quote-unquote aesthetic type of aspect. In other words, instead of them in the 1930s just going and gathering up the five brothers and lynching them on the spot, they go through a whole process to give the veneer of justice, but the mechanisms work just the same way as a lynch mob coming with hoods in the night. And the process is to maintain a particular political social order, which is part of the bedrock of white supremacy within the market capitalist framework of the American experience. And when Kunstler challenged some of this madness here, you know, and was upset what was going on in the court, not only was Kunstler later held in contempt, but the judge tried to disbar him. So in other words, just like in the days of old, there's a reaction for those folks who try to defend themselves or who try to help defend black folks. Whether we're talking about Tulia, Oklahoma, where after dropping bombs and shooting up the black community in the black financial district, then known as Black Wall Street, in 1921, those who tried to defend their community had to pay a heavy price for trying to maintain a semblance of their humanity and self-respect in the face of this brutal, barbaric, inhumane society. Now, what's also fascinating is how, as I noted, how the issues by various segments of the population began to ramp up a kind of lynch mob mentality. Now, Donald Trump, the little millionaire or billionaire, whatever the slob is, got into the mix himself. And he took out a 4-full-page ad in Newsday on May 1st, 1989, which he paid $85,000 for. And it ran in Newsday, the Daily News, the Times, and the Post. And what the ad said was this. Quote, "Bring back the death penalty. Bring back our police. What has happened is the complete breakdown of life as we know it. Many New York families have had to give up the pleasure of leisurely strolls in the park at dusk, the Saturday visit to the playground with their families, the bike ride at dawn, or just sitting on their stoops, giving them up as hostages to a world ruled by the law of the street, as roving bands of wild criminals roam our neighborhoods dispensing their own vicious brand of twisted hatred on whoever they encounter. At what point did we cross the line from the fine and noble pursuits of genuine civil liberties to the reckless and dangerously permissive atmosphere which allows criminals of every age to beat and rape a helpless woman and then laugh at her family's anguish? And why do they laugh? They laugh because they know that soon, very soon, they will be returned to the streets to rape and maim and kill once again, and yet face no great personal risk to themselves. Mayor Koch has stated that hate and rancor should be removed from our hearts. I do not think so. I want to hate these muggers and murderers. They should be forced to suffer. And when they kill, they should be executed for their crimes. Yes, Mayor Koch, I want to hate these murderers, and I always will. I am looking to punish them. I no longer want to understand their anger. I want them to understand our anger. I want them to be afraid. Let our politicians give back our police department's power to keep us safe. Unshackle them from the constant chant of police brutality, quote unquote, which every petty criminal hurls immediately at an officer who has just risked his or her life to save another's. We must cease our continuous pandering to the criminal population. Send a message loud and clear to those who would murder our citizens and terrorize New York. Bring back the death penalty and bring back our police." So here you see it in full swing, this propaganda ad by this savage, portraying that the police are held in constraint. Now, the police have been through all types of brutal murders, unjustified, savage beatings of black and Latino folks. But this so-called attack by a so-called wild mob that was engineered, this wasn't real. This was not some wild teen mob attacking this woman. This was one low-life psychopath brutalizing this woman and a number of women in the area, and it falling through the cracks of a police department that has more of a social political agenda engaged in its fabric than it does for any quote unquote safety of its citizens. But yet low-life Trump is able to ride on the whole rancor at the time and pretend that it's the police that are shackled and that it's the criminal elements like these five teens that laugh at the family members' anguish and are roaming the streets dispensing their own brand of quote-unquote twisted hatred on whomever they encounter. So this is basically certain elements of the population trying to pretend that they're victims and cascade the dispossessed as the victimizers and justifying and trying to ramp up the state apparatus for more repression in the name of safety. This helped parlay the lowering of ages for what one could be executed. Because as you notice, when he was talking about bring back our death penalty and all of that type of stuff, everyone knew that these guys were teens. So it had a political agenda that was attached. More police power, more police force state apparatus under the whole wheels of this diabolical engine. And at the same time, bring back the out-and-out lynch rule. Let's not even go through this whole charade. Let's just go back to the quote-unquote good old days. That's why I say fascism in America would be as simple as a jog in the park. Now here, Peter Neufeld, Barry Scheck's partner in the Innocence Project and also one of the lawyers in the OJ trial on the defense team, he talks about the role DNA has played in many of these cases that they have been able to overturn and offset. So dig this.
Is, for instance, had it not been for a DNA match with Mr. Reyes in the Central Park Chagra case, people like Saul Cass and other experts could talk until they're blue in the face about why a particular confession seems to be unreliable, and no one would accept it, even with his studies and experiments in the classroom. But the fact of the matter is that there have now been 27 cases of the 116 people exonerated through post-conviction DNA testing, including 12 from death row, 27 cases where false confessions played a critical role. But we wouldn't be able to prove that they were false confessions had it not been for DNA evidence, not only eliminating the person who falsely confessed, but then identifying the real perpetrator. The problem is, in most cases, there'll still be false confessions, but there'll be no biological evidence to use for DNA testing. So we have to have some other measure, some other standard that people can rely upon to assess the reliability of these confessions.
Okay, so you could see what he was talking about. It in these 116 post-conviction cases where 27 27 of the cases, including 12 death row cases, were overturned, where the DNA evidence, helped turn the cases in all of these cases. In those 27 cases out of the 116, it was based off of false confessions that they got the conviction. So you have a situation where there's a number of cases, as he's talking about, where people are confessing, but they can't get them out simply because they may have a strong suspicion that they're innocent, but they don't have biological evidence to test. There was no biological evidence left in the particular crime scene, so the people end up languishing or just later being executed and stuff. So this leads back to what him, Neufeld, and earlier Scheck were pushing for, which was the whole aspect of videotaping the whole process, so people can view how they got from one point to another. Most time during a confession, someone confesses usually within an hour or two. But when it's, when you see these cases or where the people had been interrogated for 10, 12, 20 hours, 28 hours, as in one of the CP5 cases, then one's antenna should be going up. But even with that particular evidence of how long they interrogated these people, and in the cases of the CP5, like with Youssef, it was a criminal way they interrogated, because they didn't allow him access to his parental guidance or any kind of attorney, even though he was underage. You end up with a situation where the police, of course, because they have ulterior motives and agendas, do not want the videotaping of the whole thing. They just want it when they have broken down the person and are basically tuned the person up to the point where they are now basically going to, as best they can, regurgitate out what the police want to hear and have more or less dictated for them to say. Now, once again, this also goes back to the Negroes Quit Playing program. These cats who've been involved in this, this stuff can't be tolerated. And as long as black folks, and Spanish-speaking black folks, Latinos, as long as we keep playing these games of fake protest, you know, going from one protest to another, crying about Abner Louima's torture, crying about this brutality and all of that, and then just moving on to the next brutal subject matter without any of these clowns ever really paying a price for what they have intentionally engineered, then the brutalization that we continuously face at the hooves and claws of the state will no doubt continue. That's just the real world. Now, in light of all of this, as we've seen where Kunstler added the elements of how the whole systematic process of destruction of black life plays itself out, as we've seen how Trump hyped up and propagandized the whole process, and how real reforms were rejected and have been had various apparatus try to resist with one excuse or another. During the whole process of the immediate fallout of the whole case against the CP5, an FOP, Fraternal Order of the Police, goose stepper by the name of Lou Cannon, he's from the Washington, D.C. area, he was asked what he thinks about the complete videotaping of the interrogation of suspects from start to finish, and does he feel that this is a good idea? Let's check out what he says.
It's not necessarily a bad idea. It could be a good idea as long as there's sufficient guidelines that are put in place. Number one, you're going to have to ascertain, when are you going to use these? Are you going to do them in all cases? Because if you do them in some and not in others, then you have the defense raising an objection when they're not done. Well, why was not one done in this case? So you need to have some pretty clear guidelines of when you're going to use them, what you're going to do, what is going to be the requirements for them. Does the person doing this have to be certified? Does the court have to certify them? Where are your guidelines? I think that people are going to take a look at it strongly, and I think what they have to do is when they look at it, they have to look all the way back, take a look. As I said, the guidelines are going to be enacted. Do you do it for felonies, not misdemeanors? Do you do it for crimes of violence, not crimes against property? Where are your guidelines going to be? Where are you going to draw the lines? The other thing that in today's society, obviously the economic factor and the cost of all that is going to be involved. So, I mean, those are many, many things that have to be looked at and taken into account before you proceed forward.
Shut up. This is just a charlatan. Here you have a situation where in two areas, Minnesota and Alaska, they already do the testing. So it's not like this is something that's just, first of all, it's a simple process. Just turn on the damn camera, you slob. But on top of that, see how he just goes into this, you know, when are you going to use this? Are the people going to be certified? Is the court going to have to certify them? The economic factor. I mean, give me a damn break. This is a slob. A slob cop. with fascistic tendencies that does not want to be accountable to the process of what him and others like him engineer in the political landscape. And any evidence that could help flip or expose them, there's resistance to. Look, someone turns on the camera at some point. So you didn't hear him say the economic factor to this. You don't hear him talking about, does someone need to be certified when they turn on the damn camera once they've broken someone on? Yet he wants to bring it up all of a sudden now, as if you turn on the camera earlier in the process, then all of a sudden issues about certification and what type of charges, you know, what are being, you know, on murder charges, on petty theft, etc., etc. Well, look, any area where there's a possible confession that they're going to videotape, why wouldn't you just videotape it? In other words, why would you not videotape from start to finish all interrogations? Could this possibly be something that would bankrupt the cities throughout America? Of course not. This is a joke. This is someone who is trying to put a firewall between any of the public's glimpse within the whole draconian apparatus of the state. Of course, someone like John Birch out of Chicago wouldn't want videotape, you know, of the whole thing, because then you would be seeing him torture people, putting electrodes to people's genitals, their ears, slamming them up over their head with phone books, putting plastic bags over their head and suffocating them. So after this type of process has happened for hours on end, and then the person then ends up confessing to whatever John Burge and company want, it wouldn't look too convincing if you ended up seeing the whole process. Now, would it? This is what this comes down to. But this is how wretched these guys are. These are, and the fact that he can get away with these types of statements and it come off plausible to much of the population helps give a glimpse of how really degraded this society is. This is not just about pointing out the truth to people. It's beyond, quote unquote, speaking truth to power. Because so many people in the American society and within the American experience are so invested in the maintenance of the status quo. And I'm not just talking about the elites. I'm talking people who have an investment in whiteness, who have an investment in this whole patriotic concept of America, nationalism, etc., etc., that they buy into this type of stuff, even though it's full of contradictions. But that's because they buy in to the maintenance of the overall order. Now, this is not the only thing that they've tried to resist and sidestep and hoop along about in all these abstract forms. Issues within the black community over these cops abusing steroids has popped up from Miami's the Miami River Boys, these little thug cops, you know, acting a fool and all of that type of stuff, shooting up people while all banged out on steroids. I'm not just talking using steroids. I'm talking about cats abusing steroids and stuff. And to Justin Velope possibly being a roid head, with a speculation about him, he was one of the torturers of Abner Louima. But these cops, once again, have done a good job in putting firewalls between proper and immediate testing of cops who've been involved in many of these brutalities, shootings, etc., etc., immediately in the aftermath of these incidents, and also on just a regular basis. So you've had a situation where black people throughout the country have tried to expand the type of testing that goes on amongst cops in drug testing, that goes on amongst cops in these various administrations, because they've often seen loaded out cops just go crazy. Like they're in some kind of battle zone, like they're jet fighters in a battle zone, zoned out on particular drugs in the urban area. But, of course, the American public has its moral fiber and foundation in the right place. Steroids testing in baseball is more, of course, important than steroid testing in amongst the wretched cops. Because after all, the secrecy of home run records is more profound than the secrecy of life of black people in the black community. So people like Barry Bonds being on steroids, who may eclipse certain home run records, is a more urgent cry to have Congress step in than cops zoned out on roids taking the life of black folks. In other words, we have to keep, you know, things in proper perspective in wretched America. This is the reality that we face, and how draconian and fascistic many of these elements are clearly on display in America. So once again, you have these apparatus take place, take hold at a cold, calculated level, and at a just a knee-jerk level, and a level by a population that's basically ambivalent about the life of many black folks. Now, here's Cannon, the little FOP cop, babbling once again in knee-jerk reaction and through a script about how the police go about prosecuting a case. And then Neufeld, Peter Neufeld, tries to respond to some of this rhetoric. Check this out.
I don't know if any officer gets rewarded for an arrest. The only thing we do is we act on the facts that are presented to us in any case. We establish probable cause, which is outlined by law. We take the probable cause that is gathered by the officers, it is submitted to the attorneys. The attorneys then take that, decide what, if in fact they have enough. It's presented to a grand jury, which are citizens, who then decide if there's sufficient cause. They then do an indictment. The case is then brought before a trial, where more citizens make the determination on the guilt or innocence. So it's not the police that are can be held liable, or the attorneys. This all boils down to the facts of evidence that are presented, where the probable cause is established, and then you have to take a look at it.
First of all, officers do receive rank promotions, actually, for making, you know, important collars. But that's almost beside the point.
I'd like to know
issue quite, the issue quite often is one of tunnel vision. Take the Central Park jogger case. The police lock their sights on particular suspect or suspects, and there's a tendency in many of these false confession cases to then have blinders on. Any time any discordant data comes in suggesting this may be the wrong guy and someone else might be the right guy, all too often that's ignored. In the Central Park jogger case, for instance, 2 days before this woman was attacked in the park, the same fellow, Reyes, had attacked another woman with a very similar M.O. just a couple of blocks away. The woman said that the perpetrator had a series of stitches on his chin, and described his physical features. A good detective checked with the hospitals and found out that a guy named Reyes, and they had an address for him, had done just that. That detective then got transferred, and nobody else in the police department followed up on it. No one thought about connecting the cases. Had they done that, perhaps they would not have avoided or prevented the Central Park jogger rape. But in the next 4 months, that man, Reyes, raped and murdered one woman and raped 3 other women. And those 4 crimes could have been prevented in their entirety had it not been for tunnel vision.
It's beyond tunnel vision, though. Because when these cops are locked into a particular site, they lock their sights, quote-unquote, on particular suspects. Often that's because it fits a particular political social agenda. And what I mean by that is that the reason why the drug war is being fought primarily in the black community is not because that's where most of the drugs are, but because there's a particular social and political agenda to where you take this fight. So it's not just an abstract thing where cops are just going where the drug dealing and the drug use is. 80% of cocaine use and sales is done by white folks. Even though black people are the majority who are arrested for selling and using cocaine. So there's a particular political social agenda to this whole apparatus, and these things play themselves out in particular cases also. So it's just not some kind of benign thing, as Neufeld naively believes or would have us believe. But when this slob cop talks about how you know, this whole probable cause and how you know, the cops just go after these issues outlined by the laws, gather the evidence, and they don't make advancement themselves off of this. You know, the whole aspect of asset forfeiture, as I in part went into in Wars Made Easy, the program Wars Made Easy, gives one insight of how whole departments profit off of the whole war on drugs, how they can make careers, and how their departments themselves benefit off of particular types of arrests, because they get a cut of the drug proceeds that they're involved in. So they use this asset forfeiture to confiscate homes and everything else, and neutralize people's ability quite often to defend themselves, because when they're charging people's homes and cars and things like that, and freeze their assets at the same time, if they're not charging that person directly, then that person does not automatically have a right to an attorney, because they're not charging them. They're charging their property. After they confiscate the homes, they then get a cut. And we went into that particularly in The Wars Made Easy, of how these cops have used this technique of advancement for themselves. So this cop is just talking rhetoric. Whole departments use this strategy. Now, when he also, the slob cop also talked about how, you know, the onus is not on the police or the attorneys. In other words, acting like they just gather the facts at hand and just lay them out. Well, here you have a situation where a while ago, there was a report that came out by a reporter about the Chicago police and attorney's office, where he went over 300 cases where people had been wrongly convicted, and they were convicted by either police fabricated evidence and or tampering of evidence by the attorney. Some of these cases were death penalty cases. Yet the worst punishment that anyone received in over these 300 cases were people, primarily black, were framed up by either the police and or attorney, was an attorney got a $300 fine. So when you hear this cop talk this nonsense about how basically the cops just operate on just trying to find the true evidence on the ground, and this is in the face of what had then just transpired about the blowout over the Central Park jogging case, where it was clear that the police department had coerced these teenagers, at least four of them, into confession and outright lied about the fifth one, Youssef, giving a confession, since they didn't have it on videotape and he didn't write any confession. This just shows you how cynical this whole process is, and why I emphasize once again that these types of people, why are they allowed, why are they still alive? What gives them the right to live? They are outwardly saying to us that we do not have a right to live in safety. We do not have a right to maintain our humanity under this order. Now, I'm not one of these Jesse Jackson and all of these, you know, Negro integrationist types trying to cry and whine our way into some kind of acceptability into this barbaric system. I just come hard with it. If we don't have a right to live in safety or anything else, what gives any of them? That's the real world. Any of those cops who were involved in the frame-up, any of these people like Trump, who helped propagandize a more fierce social political agenda against them. What makes them so special that they can be on, we could be the targets at a range of their target practice, yet they are never supposed to be on the receiving end? Nothing at all is so special about them that they should not be on the receiving end. That's the real world. Now here, once again, is this low-life FOP cop Cannon saying that the cop beatings for confessions have long been a thing of the past. Check this out.
That if you see that those days are long gone, where you'd have officers come in and beat confessions out of people. If you look at New York, Admiral Lima, there are officers that have gone to jail and have been convicted of that. When officers are wrong, you're absolutely correct. They should be convicted and they should go to jail for the crimes that they commit. The fact that, in the belief that officers bring people in and beat confessions out of them in this day and age, is just simply wrong.
Hey, this is some sick stuff. Because here you have a situation where, like I mentioned earlier, the Bird situation explodes out all of this nonsense right before one's eyes, if one is truly honest. But see, this cop is not honest. You had the Rampart Division scandal, where all types of manipulation and forms of confessions were ascertained by a wide variety of ways. They had to release up to 200 people because one cop gets caught stealing 8 pounds of cocaine. He's a little punk coward cop, doesn't want to do his little 5 years in jail for stealing 8 pounds of cocaine, because that's the maximum you can get if you're a cop for stealing 8 pounds of cocaine. So he starts oinking on his other pig friends. They bring the other pigs in the pig pen. They start oinking on one another, and voila, all of these brutalities that have taken on a macabre Orwellian type of script within the American police landscape start to be exposed. So for this cop to try to pretend that this type of brutality does not take place, when the evidence is all around us, even in the Mueller Commission report, exposing different techniques and things that have happened in New York, all around, one has seen various types of police conduct brutality within prison guards, the brutality that they've unleashed upon prison inmates, the Corcoran prison issue of doing turkey shoots on people, etc., etc. And at the same time, as I went into in the program The Great American Illusion, The Slave's Reality, how they out and out tortured brothers in prison by freezing cold to break them down physically. In other words, what I'm saying is this type of brutal treatment is integrated within all aspects of the American police apparatus. So to hear this cop try to pretend that this is quote unquote a thing of the past, where you've had in West Oakland the rioters who were going around physically brutalizing people who for whatever reason or another had not been convinced to become slaves and revolt and pick up the gun and defend themselves if these slobs came around. But nevertheless, the rioters went on for years in this particular escapade. And it got exposed by another cop who openly talked about what these cops were doing physically to people within the West Oakland area. So here's this slob cop. It's just pulling stuff out of his rectum to try to present an image that is as real as, you know, some Abrahamic God in the sky or Santa Claus or, you know, things of that particular nature. Now, as this apparatus clearly took place and has taken place in all these various elements, where even with insurmountable evidence in the face of what has happened to the CP5, how this was galvanized by various elements of the society to call for more brutal repression by the police and by a large segment of the public calling for more brutal repression, because within certain portions of the American population, there's like a certain acknowledgement that the draconian type laws that are going to be used in the American landscape is going to be used against the other. This whole apparatus helped set the tone for what took place in 1992. So you had a situation where the Central Park jogging case exploded in April 1989. We've gone over all of the aspects of how Trump propagandized the police manipulation, why they want to socially engineer and target certain issues like this, because it helps tune up the population for expanded powers by the state. These cats were then locked down in prison in 1992. Since they were released, they were in a situation where, like, Youssef had to register as a sexual predator every 3 months. You have to pay for you know, your whole registration as you're on parole, all of this stuff that just takes money out of a segment of the population. All of these apparatus took place to expand the fascistic life powers of the state. And none of the whole apparatus of tuning up the five suspects for 20 to 28 hours in interrogation even gave pause to much of the population, the jurors, the judges, the criminal justice system overall. Then you have all of this hype about the majority population being under siege by the wild, dark animals. Now, within that context, with all the current denial, rewriting of history, justifying the barbaric unjustifiable, this helped set up the madness of what the New York Central Park episode led to. In 92, the current mayor was David Dinkins, and the mayor was compelled to set up an all-civilian complaint review board by citizens who kept seeing themselves get gunned down and brutalized by cops, and that the cops who were would sit equally on the review board would obviously influence what kind of cases would go forward, which basically meant that the cops, if you chose to operate within this type of milieu, which I personally don't, you know where I'm coming from, but those who are operating within that milieu would see themselves in a merry-go-round of abomination type of cases. So after another unjustifiable shooting where the cop basically got off, and Dinkins said he was going to put in an all-civilian complaint review board. On September 16th, 1992, the New York police went on what was called, by some newspapers and by the public at large, a riot. They started fights in public. They were drinking and getting drunk in public. They threw out racial slurs and sexist slurs at citizens in New York. They got in fights in subways. And later, when people filed complaints, they just basically gave the complaints, the police gave the complaints over to the cops who were involved in the being accused of the complaint, and then would threaten the people by going to their home and circling around their houses and stuff like that. The New York Post wrote about the police riot, as it was described. Yet, within all of this madness, them making racist caricatures, pictures of Dinkins marching on City Hall, standing on people's cars, threatening people out in public, stopping traffic, on and on and on. You had Congressperson Susan Marinari speaking to the police at their police riot, which then turned into kind of like a political stormtrooping event. A state assembly member, Doug Hyken, also spoke. And then one of the head of the police, Lou Matarazzo, came out and spoke, and then stepped to the mic, giving basically a promotional speech and setup for the next person who is about to step to the mic, which set the next tone of what was about to grip New York as this former prosecutor later gave a hint at where he was going and who he backed in this development in New York within a police-style state apparatus. Dig this.
Next speaker is a man who's known to us all. Needs no introduction. He has spoken out with the courage of his conviction on issues that are very sensitive, such as the review board issue. He's spoken out on behalf of police officers throughout the Washington Heights situation, Crown Heights last year. I introduce to you a man who is a possible mayor of the city of New York, Rudy Giuliani.
Automatic weapons. I approved some of them when I was in the Justice Department. Transit police have automatic weapons. The mayor of the city of New York refuses to give you automatic weapons because it will be too dangerous. Just about every drug gang, just about every vicious criminal in this city has access to automatic weapons. That's what's dangerous, not giving it to you, police officers. When this mayor, with his background of sensitivity to ethics and complying with the law, when he gets in front of a police class and he talks about ethics, they laugh at him just as loud as when the citizens of this city hear him say he's the toughest mayor on crime. Once again, in the words of Guy Molinari, bullshit!
Well, there you have it. And this gives an insight of why I say that fascism in America is as simple as a jog in the park. This is this speech, if you just made a video out of it and put it in black and white, it could look like one of those speeches that you see Adolf engaged in. When you listen to some of the stuff that he was also saying, that Dinkins is the reason why the morale of the cops is so low. And that's simply because Dinkins wanted to have, or was more or less influenced to have by the public, a civilian, all-civilian police review commission. Now this caused all of the outrage that you saw amongst the cops to go on literally a riot. So the cops feeling that they be beholden within this system to the public in any way, even though they're supposed to be getting paid by the public, was something that they cannot tolerate, and literally just went on a riot. There's just no other way to describe it. But it didn't change the overall image and perception. There was no crackdown on the police by the state, because the state apparatus depends on the police for the overall control within a particular framework and maintenance of the public. So this exposes that this is not about law breaking, abiding by the law, or any of that type of stuff. Because had a regular citizen been doing half the things that the cops had done, the iron fist of the state would have been crushing upon them. But when the police engaged in this type of activity, people more or less, at the end of the day, looked the other way. And in steps in Giuliani, who basically Sig Heils out a speech that basically was to kick off a note to the cops that if I'm in administration position of backing you guys, i.e. the mayor, you won't have to worry about any of these types of constraints. Around a week later, Giuliani announced that he was running for mayor. He won, and a whole set of apparatuses started. 5 years later, we had the Abner Louima case. We know how Giuliani and others played out. Another thing that should be noticed is that Giuliani then, as you heard him say, that most cities have cops who have automatic weapons, and that the cops of New York should have automatic weapons, and the friends of those cops should have automatic weapons. Friends of the cops? So basically what he's saying is that people who are in alignment with the state should have the authority to be armed to the teeth. Not the public, but the state apparatus. And he used this type of rhetoric and parlayed that rhetoric in the issue of 41 bullets. And what I mean by that is that Giuliani, when he was later mayor, started this gun control program against the public to quote-unquote get the guns off the street. He then set up a task force of cops whose job it was to patrol the streets with the main goal of getting guns off the streets. This group turned into kind of like a Guatemalan death squad whose little code names were like "We Own the Night," which basically meant if we find you on the streets at night, Negroes, we'll kill you. Amadou Diallo was trying to enter into his house. He had a pair of keys and wallet in his hand that was close enough for the four Gestapo cops who saw him. And under their "We Own the Night" gun control street sweeping program, they shot at him 41 times, hit him 19 times. That was a result of Giuliani's measures to quote-unquote control the streets. And Giuliani was just like these others have linked the out-of-control behavior of the Central Park jogging case and other issues that have happened to parlay their careers as prosecutors and then as mayors into this draconian fascistic type of apparatus that we face. Now, Giuliani's career ends up getting another shot in the arm when 9/11 happens, and he plays quote-unquote the stern-faced commander, even though there's other evidence that he may have played another kind of central role of command concerning the 911. But now the image of Giuliani is mayor, is like one of the mayors of the decade, mayors of the century. Yet the real face of Giuliani, and when you listen to this speech about what he was parlaying and saying and what became part of the status quo of police behavior in a more ratchet up way during his administration, helps outline how easily these types of draconian policies, draconian actions, and fascistic elements are so easily absorbed within the fabric of America. All you need is the proper scapegoats. The dumpification of a population that is dedicated on short-term memory, on denial, on a wretched form of dehumanization from Central Park to Iraq. The game is played in a similar way. And the results for the slaves is often played out the same way. Now, in the aftermath of what exploded with the CP5, the various attorneys had called for the dissolving of the charges against the framed up victims. There was no punishment towards any of the cops who had been involved. And as many of you know, the punishment is not going to come from that apparatus in the end. But in many ways, the mission had been accomplished. They used the CP5 and got what they wanted and needed. I'm talking about the state, those who are defenders of the state. They put in much more wretched legislation. They were able to destroy fabrics of the targeted communities even more. They were able to
annihilate segments of basic human rights of the population that they don't look at as humans. And they were able to parlay in parlor trick politicians who are status quo engineers and deviant psychopaths for an order that has no form or elements of humanity within it. Once again, outlining how in the Americanist landscape, fascism in America will be as simple as a jog in the park. Hold on a sec.
The death penalty is, of course, a direct descendant of lynching when the Death Belt was getting such a bad press for lynching people in the 30s and 40s. We went to these very perfunctory death penalty trials as a way of accomplishing the same thing. And a lot of people think that's ancient history, but it's still going on. There are cases here in the South where I practice that take 2 or 3 days for a person to be sentenced to death. Alabama, for example, has carried out 12 executions. 9 of those have been of African-American men. Some of them were represented by lawyers that the average person wouldn't have represent them on a minor traffic accident. One of the people was the brief filed by the lawyer on the direct appeal was only 1 page long. If a student had turned that in a first-year legal writing class, they would have been flunked out of law school. The place where we see this so often with the death penalty is the prosecutor's decision whether or not to seek the death penalty or not. The criminal justice system is the part of our society least affected by the civil rights movement. And generally that decision, whether to go for the death penalty or not, or whether to resolve the case with a plea bargain short of death, is made by one white man. And very often, those people, those prosecutors, will use the death penalty to get a lot of publicity, a lot of name recognition, and then they'll run for judge in the next election. We have right now, in Georgia, the prosecutor who's been the leading death penalty prosecutor, to put it that way, is now up for a judgeship. Someone whose long history of race discrimination personally got the death penalty against a mentally retarded African-American youth who was executed a few years ago. He struck all the black people from the jury to get an all-white jury. He's indicated complete contempt for the Bill of Rights, saying the way to get confessions is to shake up a pop bottle and put it under the suspect's nose to get them to confess. And yet this person is about to become a judge and now will be the person that poor people and African Americans, people of color, look to for justice in the courts in Georgia. The system that works the best for the state in terms of greasing the track to the electric chair is to appoint individual lawyers who don't have any training, as William Moffitt just pointed out, who often, I mean, we've seen a number of these cases. Shirley Tyler, a woman here in Georgia, was tried by a lawyer. It was his first case out of law school, was his death penalty case. And there have been a number of cases like that. The lawyers are appointed by the judges. So this judge I talked about a moment ago, a prosecutor who's made his way to the bench by prosecuting death penalty cases, then appoints the lawyers, and there's no question. We have elected judges, judges who run on the same sort of demagogic platforms as people running for other offices. They often appoint the most inexperienced and most unqualified lawyers to these cases. But the big reason is money. There's no money in it. The death penalty cases pay less than almost particularly down south, $20-$30 an hour.
$2,500 cap in Virginia.
Right. Virginia, I think, is the absolutely lowest. Virginia, Kentucky, I think, anywhere in the country. Well, actually, Alabama has a limit of no more than $2,000 for time spent out of court. So that means if you spend 500 hours getting ready for a death penalty case in Alabama, you get $4 an hour. But we see cases all the time. Judy Haney, one of our clients, was represented by a lawyer who was so intoxicated during the trial that the judge had to stop the trial in Talladega, Alabama for a day and send the lawyer to jail. Out, and then the next day, both Ms. Haney and her client were brought back from jail, and the trial resumed, and she received the death penalty. Now, that's the kind, and the Alabama courts upheld it. A lot of our circuits down here, every single judge sitting on the bench is a former prosecutor, and they're not people who are terribly sensitive to the defense function in the case. The other thing, though, is I think a lot of times it's just economics. The judges don't want to bother the lawyers who are making a lot of money or the lawyers at the big law firms with these cases, and so they appoint either the young, inexperienced lawyers who don't have much to do and will take a case for $20 or $30 an hour, or the old broken-down alcoholic lawyers who are making a living on court-appointed work because that's the only kind of work that they can get. And tragically, there are a lot of people like that in the legal profession, I'm sorry to say. If you're going to have, on the prosecution side, we have prosecutor's offices where people make a career of prosecuting criminal cases. They advance politically. They get a salary. That's all they do. They go to training programs, and they're good at what they do. There are attorney general's offices where all they do is concentrate on trying to carry out the death penalty or get cases affirmed on appeal. There's nothing on the other side. The poor person facing the death penalty may be appointed, as I said, a lawyer who's trying his or her first case. Alfred Leatherwood in Mississippi actually was represented by a third-year law student in a death penalty case. And often those people, unlike the Simpson case, they do not have the expert witnesses that you need. Gary Nelson spent 11 years on death row in Georgia based on testimony of somebody from the crime lab who said a hair from the victim's body matched Gary Nelson. Turned out it didn't. Turned out that when it was later looked at by an independent expert, it didn't even have sufficient characteristics to be compared, and he was freed after 11 years on death row for a crime that he didn't do. But he was represented by one lawyer who was paid $2,500 and who was not given any money even for an investigator, let alone for an expert witness to look at and analyze the state's case.
When Hurricane Katrina struck, and the world saw every level of the government doing nothing to help the mostly black people in the region, who did the media use as a diversion first? Black youth, specifically black young men, who were derided for looting. And the demonization starts early as grammar school. In March of last year, two police officers entered an elementary school in St. Petersburg, Florida, after school officials called them to deal with a five-year-old black girl who was being disruptive and had punched the school official. Video footage shows her calming down. She was, you know, very agitated, but when the police came in, she calmed down. So she calmed down before the officers approached, pinned her arms behind her back, and put her in handcuffs. She was put in the back of a police car and had her feet restrained as well, after cops say she tried to kick out the window. Police officials later said that officers had committed an error of judgment, but that they did not violate policy. And of course, we all know about police brutality, or police policy towards blacks. 2 days after the incident in Florida, the assistant principal at PS 34 up in Queens made her 13 Haitian students sit on the floor and eat their rice and beans with their hands. She screamed at them in front of the rest of the students in the lunchroom. In Haiti, they treat you like animals, and I will treat you the same way here. Later, the principal pulled the students out of class. The principal, so this is the assistant principal who did this to the kids, and then the principal later on pulled the students out of the class, tried to convince them that it had never happened, and offered them some ice cream if they changed their story. In January, officials in the Brockton Public School District in Massachusetts suspended a six-year-old Haitian boy from an elementary school for the outrageous charge of sexual harassment. This is from the article. Quote, the child was playing with his classmates when a white female child touched him. He responded by touching the back of her shirt. When the girl complained to the teacher accused him of sexual harassment. He was isolated in a corner and told he must look down and not make eye contact with the other students. The teacher refused to allow the child to eat lunch with the other children and made him put his head down on the desk in his classroom while the other children were at lunch. With the number of teachers present, the little girl's mother was allowed to yell at the boy and threaten him until he was in tears. Unlike the little boy's parents, the girl's mother had been called immediately. At this point, white adult administrators subjected the boy to repeated questioning, which included scolding and other frightening and abusive behavior. He was coerced into signing a statement without his parents present or any advocate or lawyer. At the close of this internal investigation, the Brockton School District gave the child a 3-day suspension, to a 5-year-old, mind you, and immediately called the Plymouth District Attorney and school police. Up until this point, the school district had failed to contact the boy's family.
As has been made clear, for the slaves, America is a death sentence. And it's time us slaves put the noose on Sam and his administrators. For these administrators are nothing more than those who wish to, at the end of the day, dispossess us for any semblance of humanity. As they work within a machine that has all the elements of a fascistic, draconian, deviant mechanism riding through all aspects of their engines. Fascism in America is as simple as a jog in a park. But let's burn down their park and their plantation and not make it as simple as these dogs think it's going to be. Until the next time. Slave out.